This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota. Today we're going to start our show talking about something that's been getting a lot of discussion, and lots more is coming, I'm sure. It's what will happen when schools reopen in the fall, and how will they reopen, and in what ways will instruction be affected by the pandemic? And today we're going to talk about this with Nick Archuleta. He's the president of North Dakota United, which represents a lot of the state's teachers. Thanks for being with us, Nick.
Hey, thank you for having me, Doug.
How many teachers do you represent?
Well, North Dakota United represents 11,500 members. The majority of them are K-12 teachers and education support staff. But we also have strong numbers in our higher ed contingency as well. And we also represent public employees at the state, the county, and the municipal level.
How have you discussed the topic of reopening schools with your members?
Well, as you know, Governor Burgum has left the decisions about reopening up to the local school districts. And that is as it should be. The virus in this pandemic isn't affecting every school district the same way. So I think he definitely avoided a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach to this. And I believe the school districts appreciate that. So when we have discussions with teachers, I had a meeting with all of our local education association presidents, many of whom actually made the meeting, and their opinions ran the gamut from let us open as we always have because we don't have a high number of infection here to man, we should probably just start the year 100% online. So depending on where you live in the state, your opinion may differ.
So you've discussed it with them. I'm wondering, have you noticed, do you know through the grapevine whether teachers are retiring or leaving the profession at more than the usual rate because of the threat of the pandemic?
There has been some discussion about that, yes. I don't know that it is above the usual rate, but I do know that there are some people, some teachers that have contacted me, and they have said that, you know, I was going to go two more years, but with my underlying health conditions, I just think it's too much of a risk to stay, and they have left. Now, we'll see as the school year gets close, an uptick in retirements or not. And I think a lot of that has to do with how transparent school districts are in developing their plans.
Do you know anything about support staff, like janitorial staff, or for that matter, substitute teachers?
Yes, we do know that education support professionals have an incredibly important role to play in all of this. These are the folks that make sure that the transportation is clean and reliable, that prepare the food in our schools for our students, and that keep the facilities themselves clean. And so yeah, they have a huge role to play, and they are as concerned as teachers and parents as to how will these schools reopen as safely and as healthfully as possible.
Are you advocating waiting until after Labor Day to open schools for students and teachers? I know that you mentioned that the governor and Kirsten Baszler, the superintendent of public instruction, have left it up to the districts. But are you advocating sort of a bit of a delay to give a little more time or not?
Well, I think where it's appropriate, they certainly should. I see that Fargo Public Schools has floated the idea of starting after Labor Day, and that might very well be prudent in Cass County. I know it's under consideration in other districts across the state, as well as should be, because first of all, you can't develop a plan without letting or making sure that your staff, your students, their families know exactly what's in that plan. There are some things that are going to be different, and I think we can use the extra time to make sure that everybody's on the same page once those schoolhouse doors are open.
Do you work or meet with the State School Boards Association, particularly on this issue?
Yes, and in fact, we've met with the school boards and the administrators group, as well as the governor's office and the Department of Health on a fairly regular basis. And the concerns on all of these groups are the same. We have one, whether you're a teacher, whether you are an administrator, or whether you're a school board member, your number one concern is the health and safety of those students. And by virtue of the fact that they share the same spaces, our teachers and our education support professionals. So it is important that we get this right, because the public is going to have confidence in each individual school district's plan if they are, in fact, going to send their children back to school.
I think a great concern about the whole issue right now is there's a lot of pressure to reopen these schools and get back into classrooms, simply because there's concern about what happened during the spring when people were distance learning largely, and how effective that might have been, particularly for certain age groups or people of a certain economic status, or people whose parents weren't, you know, students whose parents weren't home. Different age groups, economic status, parents' presence, how effective was the emergency distance learning before the summer break?
I believe that by and large it was fairly successful. Now, there are some groups that didn't learn well. We do know that those students who struggled with school times struggled with distance learning as well. We do know that it is very difficult to teach children to read over a computer. And those are considerations that we have to take into account. I can tell you this, that no one wants to return to in-person teaching and learning more than North Dakota's teaching professionals. They understand how important it is to build those relationships with students and to let those kids know that they're there for them, that they love them, and that they are the focus of their attentions. When they're not able to meet with their students, it's very tough on everybody, including teachers. But we also know that we have to be really sure that our schools are as safe as possible before we bring those kids back. And so that's what we're in the process of doing right now.
Do you anticipate that when these schools do reopen and teachers are again in front of classrooms, at least for some of the days of the week, that there will be a process of assessing how much learning did happen during the spring and whether or not there's some remedial learning that will be necessary?
I believe that is a front of mind for everybody in the education profession. We have to know where to start these young people back on their learning path. Now, I want to emphasize didn't stop. When the schools were closed to students, we did a remarkable job across the state of getting our distance teaching and learning up and approved and on online. And so their learning did continue, but in some groups, there would probably be some interrupted learning. Just how much learning loss has occurred, we always know that there's a certain amount of that over the summer. And I think the prudent thing to do is to assess that as soon as possible once these students return to the classroom.
Nick Archuleta is president of North Dakota United, which represents thousands of teachers in the state. You can find out more about their organization at ndunited.org. And Nick, I went there, and on your website, you posed 7 questions that are related to the pandemic and reopening schools. So let's go through them and kind of get your reaction to what you'd like to hear for the answers. What will schools do if a child is infected, and how about a teacher? That's one of your questions.
It is, and I should tell you that these are questions that were asked of me by teachers, and so I thought that it would be a good idea to share those publicly. And this is going to, because the decision is left up to each individual school district, this might vary from place to place. Part of the governor and superintendent of public instruction, Kirsten Baszler, was that these plans should be developed with the local health units. And so I'm confident that they will develop a plan. As I said, this could vary from school district to school district. But when a child becomes infected, that there will have to be, separate, if it happens at school, they'll have to have a quarantine area designated in that school. And same thing with teachers. If they become infected at school and become ill at school, so I would assume that it would have something to do with of course, there has to be a good system of contact tracing to know exactly who these individuals came into contact with, and their health needs to be monitored immediately as well.
And a number of districts, surveys were sent out about a month ago or so, asking parents about what they would likely be doing with their kids this school year. And one of the questions was whether or not they might be homeschooling. Do you expect a significant increase in homeschooling? And for that matter, if a child is infected or a teacher is infected, do you expect some parents to basically say, okay, we're going to homeschool now?
I don't know if at all I expect a significant increase in homeschooling. And your listeners should know that there's a difference between homeschooling and distance learning.
Yes, quite a big difference.
Yes, quite a large difference. And I believe if folks are intending to homeschool their children, they have to have some paperwork on file with the district prior to the beginning of the school year. But so I do know that there has been expressed to me from some folks in my neighborhood and people I've spoken with, even at the grocery store, that they're very concerned that the enough to send their kids back to it. The goal, of course, is to make sure that our schools don't just open in the fall, but that they stay open. And so to the extent that we can mitigate the risk of infection, we should be doing that.
Another question that's up there, and this is a pretty important one, I think, for teachers. If a teacher is forced into a 14-day quarantine because a child or colleague contracts the virus, will that teacher have to use his or her sick days? Those are valuable.
Yes, they are valuable. And frankly, you know, our legislature didn't come back into session to specifically related to the coronavirus and COVID-19. So basically, school districts are going to be left to their own devices about this. Every teacher in North Dakota is under contract. K-12 teachers are the only group that is guaranteed the right to collectively bargain the terms and conditions of their employment, and leave is one of those conditions. So I would assume that they are going to follow the negotiated agreement in each district. There might be some way to work in, say, the Family and Medical Leave Act provisions into this. But right now, that is one of those questions that is unanswered and probably will remain so until there is an actual case where this has to be addressed.
And of course, contracting the virus is one thing, getting very, very ill is another. So, and that's a lot more sick days if that happens.
Certainly.
Will the Center for Disease Control guidelines for wearing masks and social distancing be applied in every school in each district? And why wouldn't they be?
Well, you know, the research on masks is fairly clear, and I know it was a little sketchy at the beginning, but the research on masks is quite clear that they help reduce the rate of infection. In fact, I think it was just ago, maybe not even that long ago, where Dr. Redfield, who was the head of the CDC, said that if we all wore masks for 4 to 8 weeks, we could drive the infection rate down below 1%. I mean, and that basically effectively gets rid of the threat of the coronavirus or the COVID-19. So that is an important point. And, you know, we talk about what schools can do to make sure that they're safe places for teaching and learning. Every community has a responsibility to do what they can do to make sure that their communities are safe places. And that involves something very inexpensive. Wear a mask, wash your hands, and to make sure that you're socially distancing. If we can do those things for 2 months, we would talk a lot less about schools being safe because we can practically guarantee that they would be safe.
Now, there are some things that happen at schools that, besides the classroom where kids get together, food service is one, busing of students is another, athletic events or other group events. Are there ideas or recommendations for that kind of occurrence?
Yes, there are some things that we can do to make those areas of school life safer. Eating in your classroom, for example, might be one of those things, whereas you don't have kids in congregate areas eating and talking. And I don't know if you've ever been in a school cafeteria.
Oh, yes.
It can be loud. And you can imagine the particles that will be spread with kids will be unmasked while they're eating and their lunch and drinking their milk.
Well, when I was a kid, we had food fights occasionally.
I witnessed one or two of those in my career as well. Not necessarily participated in one, I'm happy to tell you. But we can do that. We could have meals in our classrooms. Regarding sports, I see that they are going to have fall sports, so it's incumbent upon those coaches and administrators and the students themselves and their families to make sure that that those areas are as safe as they can possibly be.
Busing students, are they going to have more buses because they can't cram people into the buses the way they used to?
You know, each district is going to handle this differently as well. I do know that this is a huge concern, particularly for more rural districts. in that it's very difficult to ensure social distancing on a bus. The other thing is, I know in a lot of areas that we have people who are retired that become bus drivers. Now, as we know, the older you get, the more susceptible you are to the more harmful effects of COVID-19. And so we will see what happens in terms of whether or not those folks who have driven buses for districts in a long time are willing to take that risk. It will depend on how safe we can make those school buses.
Nick Archuleta is president of North Dakota United. We're looking at a number of questions that are on the website, indyunited.org, and Nick says they were submitted by teachers in discussions about the reopening of schools this fall. And this number four one, Nick, is somewhat problematic right now. What key data points will be monitored to inform the decisions of reopening teams? Right now, the state's posting its biggest numbers yet.
Absolutely, and I would think that one of the data points that they're going to want to look at is the rate of infection in their communities. I'm not exactly certain if that is information that's being reported for each community or not, but perhaps it's time to do that. And that, even that can probably be a little misleading. Cases are in nursing homes. Does that mean that your schools are more at risk? I don't know the answer to that, but I do want people to know that that there are certain data sets and key data sets that should be monitored, and rate of infection, I believe, is one of them. But like I said, each school district will come up with their own.
This next question is very intriguing to me, and it I think it reminds us of how complicated teaching can be. What if only 60% of parents feel that our schools are safe, 40% do not, and choose to have the district distance learning for their children? Will teachers be expected to have two preps for each class?
This is a vexing question, to be sure. Some folks have said, well, why not just put a camera in the class when they're doing the face-to-face, and then they can just broadcast that out. Well, it's an entirely different thing. Having face-to-face interaction with students is different than teaching online, and it's different in learning. I think in the bigger districts, they can probably make some adjustments in that area, but I'm worried for some of the medium and smaller sized districts who don't. So what we're here is some direction as to what will be that policy for each individual district, and will that mean that the teacher will have an extra prep and be paid for that prep? We will find out as these plans come out.
Earlier, we dealt with the question of whether or not the guidelines by the CDC for wearing masks and social distancing will be applied in every district. The other issue here is who supplies that stuff. Will students and staff have reliable and effective personal protection equipment? Do they bring it themselves? Does a school provide it? And for that matter, are there recommended adjustments to classrooms to enhance safety, like shielding or, making sure the desks are at least 6 feet apart, all that kind of stuff?
Well, socially distancing students is a very difficult thing to do in a school. It's a congregate place where people come together to learn and enrich their learning. So the social distancing piece of that is going to be very, very difficult. Who should pay for that? I think that the Congress has a role. A couple of months, we've seen the HEROES Act languishing in the Senate chamber with not being acted on. In that bill, there is money for school districts and for communities. So if that's not going to be the vehicle that Republicans in the Senate want to use, I think it is incumbent upon them they're comfortable with, but that contains that sort of funding for our local school districts and for our local communities so that they can provide for the necessary personal protective equipment that teachers and students need, as well as for the modifications to classrooms to make sure that the threats are mitigated.
Well, funding for personal protection equipment is one thing, but we're also hearing there are shortages of it everywhere, at least in lots of places where there are lots of cases to deal with. I'm talking about hospitals and emergency personnel who are scrambling still to find enough personal protection equipment. So how about that? If there isn't enough, does that get in the way of actually having congregate classes?
It certainly does. I mean, we don't want to put people into situations where they don't have the necessary protective gear. The fact that that we're this far into this pandemic and we don't have decent stockpiles of personal protective equipment, frankly, tells me that we've had a bit of a breakdown in the supply chain. So we need to get that fixed. And now is the time to be working on that. I'm confident that the folks at in our government is working on that. And let's hope that they remedy that as soon as possible.
The last of your seven questions that are posted on your website, indyunited.org, is what will be the trigger that sends all students home and reinstates distance learning? I would suspect that this might be one of them that we were just talking about. But what kinds of things would basically say, we just can't do this right now this way?
Well, as I've mentioned countless times right now, I guess, is that these plans are being developed locally, but there is a local health unit component to this. So once you start seeing an uptick in, a sharp uptick in the rate of infection in your community, that might be a triggering event. If you see a case in your school, that could be a triggering event, depending on the number of contacts that student or staff has had. So, like I say, it'll vary from district to district, but I would think that it will lean very, very heavily on the health of the students and staff.
It would also seem that this is a teachable moment, that this is a very unique piece of history we're living through, and that students in particular might learn something about the greater good, if you will, or the way we live in a society where there are lots of different cultures and lots of different means, if you will, and that, you know, we're all in it together kind of thing.
Yes. Oftentimes in American history, when you look back, you can see where tragic events actually unified this country. Recently, of course, in the 9/11 attacks in 2001, members of Congress came out arm in arm, and you know they were unified in their response. And this is that's when America is at its best. It's one of those moments. It's not time for partisanship. The pandemic doesn't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. But we also need to ensure that we don't go back to just the way it was before the pandemic, because prior to the pandemic, something on the order of 40% of Americans couldn't afford an unexpected $400 bill.
Yes.
In a month. That tells me that we are not doing what we can to make sure that people have a living wage, that people are able to save money. So we need to really rethink about the equity that we have in our society. We do know that people of color have been more negatively impacted than other Americans, and we need to find out why. Are there underlying health conditions endemic in some of those communities? To figure out what we can do to remedy that, and to make sure that people have health insurance.
That might be the real bottom line here. Universal health insurance might become the hottest issue it's ever been, and it's been a hot issue.
It has.
Okay. Well, you represent 11,500 people at North Dakota United. How would you describe the circumstances facing the other workers you represent?
Well, there again, you know, the fact that, let's just say in state government, the work hasn't gone away. And so we want to make sure that those folks' lives aren't negatively impacted either, because, frankly, North Dakotans have come to rely on a very high standard for service, and our public employees have provided that. During the last recession, we saw a lot of jobs that were vacant go unfilled. We saw layoffs as a result of the allotments that we had in the recent past, and some of those folks weren't replaced. So we have fewer public employees doing the same or more work. And I don't have to tell you that once you start with that kind of a stress level and you know, the cavalry isn't coming, it takes its toll. And there is a cost associated with replacing people. So I think what we need to do is to make sure that we don't forget about the people who are providing those vital public services as we emerge from this pandemic.
Nick Archuleta is president of North Dakota United. Again, more information about what they do at ndunited.org. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Doug, thank you for having me.
Next on Main Street, we'll hear about the challenges for nurses during the pandemic, but first, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A new survey of Minnesota educators suggests distance learning is the preferred choice of teaching heading into a new school year. The survey was released by Education Minnesota, which represents some 86,000 union members across the state. President Denise Specht says over 20,500 members responded to the survey from July 16th through the 20th.
The most popular answer was to continue distance learning, with 49% of the respondents. But 46% of the educators surveyed said they were comfortable doing at least some in-person learning, with either full-time or some part-time hybrid in between.
Specht says 59% of educators say they were uncomfortable returning to in-person education, even if their schools met all safety standards.
Learning safely is the goal. It should be done in person when we can, and at a distance when we must.
The Minnesota Department of Education is expected to release guidance for the start of school sometime next week. North Dakota has lost 10 years of labor growth during the pandemic. UND economist Dr. David Flynn says from oil to retail, you can tie the dramatic loss to COVID-19 issues. Flynn says the state's unemployment rate went from 2% in March to record highs of 9.1% in April and May. He says businesses are still struggling with consumer confidence.
When you try and evaluate a business decision on somebody else's fear, it's obviously very, very difficult.
Flynn adds small business owners are having to make difficult decisions with little history to go by.
Is it going to increase the confidence of their patrons if they require masks in the store? Or does it push away some other patrons? How many employees can they afford to bring back? How many employees do they need to get in order to be a productive and efficient and profitable business unit?
North Dakota's unemployment rate in June was 6.1%. That compares to 2.4% 1 year ago. And a third juvenile male has been arrested in connection with last Friday's shooting death of former University of North Dakota Provost Tom DiLorenzo in Charleston, South Carolina. Charleston police say a 15-year-old was taken into custody Thursday evening and charged with murder and attempted armed robbery. DiLorenzo was shot and killed during an attempted robbery last Friday morning when walking with his wife, who had just taken a job at the College of Charleston. Two other juvenile males, aged 15 and 16, were arrested that day and charged with his murder. DiLorenzo was 63. He spent 7 years at UND until recently retiring. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation. On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
American women marched, picketed, and went to prison in their fight for the vote. Witness the historic 72-year battle for women's suffrage.
Watch One Woman, One Vote, tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we have another excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast. Hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter feature Dr. Susan Hassmiller, Senior Advisor for Nursing at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Her experience and honors are wide and deep. She directs the Futures in Nursing Campaign for Action in partnership with the AARP. She's also senior scholar in residence and senior advisor to the President on Nursing at the National Academy of Medicine and is currently working to craft the Future of Nursing 2030 report. Dr. Hassmiller is a fellow of the American Academy of Nursing and a recipient of the Florence Nightingale Medal, the highest honor given for nursing by the International Red Cross. In this conversation, she talks about the dramatic role America's 3.8 million nurses play in addressing the COVID-19 pandemic.
Dr. Hassmiller, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
We're celebrating the Year of the Nurse. I don't know how to describe the time that we're in, certainly with the backdrop of COVID-19 pandemic. And nurses are clearly on the front lines of the response, particularly for critical care or emergency nurse specialists. But perhaps more shocking is the number of nurses who are actually dying on the front lines really being sent into battle with inadequate protection, such as even some of the most basic PPE. And all this harsh reality has shown a spotlight on the profession. I'm wondering if you could just talk about how the crisis has put a spotlight on nurses.
I think if people didn't know this before, they would know this now. Mm-hmm. Nurses have never been more in the news. I think people are seeing that nurses are the glue holding this all together. I was struck by a table that I saw in The Economist of the most dangerous profession. And right on the top right-hand corner with the biggest bubble was nursing. And any nurse and physician really understand that both physicians and nurses are equally important, but it's really the nurse that's in the room mostly. And you see nurses with their iPads. This is the most crushing thing that I saw throughout this whole pandemic, was nurses with their iPads trying to connect the patient with their family members because the family members couldn't be there when their loved one was even dying. So we always, you know, with the Future of Nursing Campaign for Action that I direct, we are always letting nurses know, speak up for your rights. And I think we are seeing nurses who have found their voice. They really are doing the work that they feel that they were called to do. And I think they are getting recognized. I've been struck by the number of nurses who are feeling psychologically battered. I wonder if our profession is going to be decimated, or will nurses feel, wow, this is what we have been called to do all this time, mm-hmm. and people are recognizing this. So I think nurses are finding their voice. Some nurses have been fired over yes, their voice.
That's right.
And demanding more PPE. But we're clearly seeing them as the glue, really expressing a lot of compassion. Mm-hmm. Nurses and physicians, all healthcare providers, really go into their profession mm-hmm. to, you know, connect with people in this way. But with all of the technology and the rules and the regulations that nurses have to follow, sometimes mm-hmm. they don't have the time and can't make that connection they want to make. Mm-hmm. And I think this pandemic, as horrible as it has been, has allowed nurses to really come forward and show the compassion and empathy that they've always wanted to in their mm-hmm. career.
You have such a really large role. You've been advising the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the National Academy of Medicine on the critical importance of investing in the continued advancement of the nursing profession, the largest discipline within healthcare in the U.S., 3.8 million nurses, to advance training and education for nurses, and then to make sure that they can use that training and education to practice at the highest level. And we're very instrumental in drafting the national study that led to the Institute of Medicine report, The Future of Nursing 2020. Can you highlight some of the goals that were established then and share with us how close have we come to achieving them and maybe in some cases even exceeded them?
So the first report was about building capacity. We need more nursing leaders. We need more nurses to go on for doctorate degrees, we need more nursing faculty. We need to diversify our profession. All nurses, here's the big one, right? One of the big ones, all nurses need to practice to the top of their education and training. And more nurses need to have a baccalaureate degree. Back when the first report was published, we had more associate degree nurses in this country than we had baccalaureate, masters, and more highly prepared nurses. It matters when it comes to not only the quality of nursing care. If you have a baccalaureate degree, you're going to have more information and more clinical experience around population health. And we also knew it was more important to have baccalaureate degrees because of the pipeline. We always have had a severe nursing faculty shortage. Now, for the first time in the history of forever, we have more baccalaureate nurses than we do have associate degree nurses. Mm-hmm. We haven't reached the goal. The goal was 80% by 2020. But we have reached a cultural shift in this country around that particular recommendation, because any nurse now that is in their associate degree program, if you ask them to raise their hand, how many of you will go on for a baccalaureate degree? They pretty much all do. It's mm-hmm. just the way mm-hmm. the culture is now. Mm-hmm. I will tell you where we do not have a cultural shift, and that is for nurse practitioners to go to school for all the years that they go to school, and then they come out and they can't practice what they learned in school. We've made progress since 10 years ago. We brought along 7 more states, but that's not a cultural shift. Mm-hmm. We only have 22 states in this country where nurses are allowed to practice, as I say, what they learned in school. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we've had a pandemic, but fortunately, 7 additional states have relaxed their regulations so that their nurse practitioners could easily provide telehealth and practice without physician supervision. We know more nurses are getting onto boards of directors. We are trying to encourage nurses all over the country to have a voice like we are in this pandemic. You know, you have an important role to play in healthcare, prevention, population health. Your voice as one of the biggest and trusted advocates in this country need to be on that board. Recommendations, diversity, we aren't where we should be, but I think we're making very important strides in diversifying our profession. Mm-hmm. More Blacks, Hispanics than ever are coming into nursing. The thing we're not seeing is that the higher the nurses go in their profession, the least likely they are to be diverse.
You're now overseeing the development of the Future of Nursing 2030 report. We know nursing is this incredible blend of science and complex technology and the art of healing into practice. And how are we starting to think about the role of nursing as a particular profession, not only in the issues of technology, but the globalization of our responses and the role that nurses will play?
I characterize the first Future of Nursing report as an attempt to build the capacity of the nursing profession. So now we're saying, building the capacity of the nursing profession to what end? Mm-hmm. Right. What are those things that really matter most in our country, in the world, globally, in terms of keeping someone healthy and well? It's not always having the best brain surgeon, the smartest nurse practitioner, but really the most important things that keep our country and really all countries healthy are social determinants and the inequities and the disparities that we need to pay more attention to. Where someone lives, the neighborhood they live in, the transportation system they have, the food supply in their community. And all these issues are so important, and they've been brought to excruciating light during this pandemic. And so this second report has to do with the nurse's role in addressing health equity in this country. Technology will be a part of this report. It has been such an important part of our healthcare system, and even more so in this pandemic. We have to make sure that everyone has a fair and just opportunity to be healthy and well. We want to make sure that technology is used to justly provide care. 15% of everybody in this country do not have broadband access in their home. So technology is going to make a big difference. It's already made a big difference, but we can't let it be a barrier to the compassion, to the empathy that people feel for us. 4 years ago, I lost my husband in a bicycle accident, and he lived for 10 days in an intensive care unit. And I was horrified, quite frankly, with the level of technology that was used, but it came at the cost of not providing the empathy and the support that I also felt was critically needed in a time where I was losing my best friend.
Yeah. Well, Susan, the Robert Johnson Foundation has as its mission statement that it's going to promote a culture of health in this country. And the biggest one that we focus on is the difference in life expectancy in groups that endure racial and ethnic disparities. We're in an advantageous spot as nurses to address many of these systemic issues, but we're also seeing COVID claiming more people of color. You know, what's your vision of how nurses leverage their role as this largest group of healthcare professionals to really fundamentally address these health disparities in the country?
The Gallup poll that's taken every year that shows that nurses are the most trusted profession. That goes a long way when we are talking about inequities, trying to ensure that everyone has a fair and just chance at being healthy and well. When I'm sitting here in Minneapolis where George Floyd incident happened, there's so much distrust, but nurses have got to play a critical and primary role in this relationship building, in this trust. We have found through a survey that nurses do want to make connections for people in terms of their food supplies and whether they can get into doctor's offices and they have access to healthcare once they leave a hospital per se. But there's not always the mechanisms or the support, the technological support or the administrative support for nurses to ask those questions and make those connections. Healthcare systems are bringing in technology so that nurses in their assessments can ask these very important questions of people and flag some of the inequities that may be occurring in that person's life. But where the moral distress comes in, and this would be moral distress for any profession, that if nurses ask these questions, if they don't then have a means of connecting the patients or people to those resources, then there becomes a sense of moral distress. My role with this next report is to remind nurses of the history that has been so vivid in their own life. Florence Nightingale, Lillian Wald. Lillian Wald was the first public health nurse in New York City, the Henry Street Settlement. She paid every bit of attention to the kids' education level, whether they were going to school. She found that men who lost their jobs, the children were more at risk for being healthy. So she made all of these connections. Nurses have been doing this. It's part of their history. And I feel it's my role to remind nurses of this very important role, trusting role that they have, and to get back to that. But hospitals and health systems have got to support nurses in this role that they want to play with the resources that are needed.
We're speaking today with Dr. Susan Hassmiller, Senior Advisor for Nursing at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, where she also directs the foundation's Future of Nursing Campaign for Action in partnership with the AARP. She's currently the Senior Scholar in Residence and Senior Advisor to the President of Nursing at the National Academy of Medicine. And Dr. Hassmiller, you just mentioned Florence Nightingale. Among the many awards, you've also received the coveted Florence Nightingale Award from the International Red Cross. I understand you were inspired earlier in your career with the work of that organization. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what you learned and what we might learn from other countries and how their nursing professions are able to impact health systems.
I'm so proud to have been a volunteer for the Red Cross since my college days when the Red Cross helped me find my parents in an earthquake in Mexico City. So that's the connection. You know, the International Red Cross is guided by humanitarian principles. A man by the name of Henri Dunant, who stumbled across a war that was going on and tried to help both sides. And he figured out that there was no real organization to provide humanitarian support, relief, healthcare. The International Red Cross is always involved in refugee health, the border crisis, and in a very neutral stance. The Red Cross has a particularly very difficult job right now. In our country, they are congressionally mandated. It's an unfunded mandate. All money to the Red Cross comes through voluntary contributions. But they are congressionally mandated to respond to disasters. And so how hard is it now to respond to any disasters? And our hurricane season is coming up. Right. To respond to people in a humanitarian, compassionate way during a pandemic. They have to protect their volunteers just like you have to protect your employees. Right. The Red Cross has to protect their volunteers and cannot put them in precarious situations. So my heart goes out to people who are victims of disasters these days. They'll get what Red Cross can give them at this point. But, you know, my heart goes out to everyone trying to deal in this pandemic. And then globally, things are different. For those of us who are fortunate to be in other countries, to have been in other countries, we know that other countries pay much more attention to population health. There's one graph, a graph of about, I'll say, 20 countries of what countries spend on medical care. Every other country spends more on social care and the social needs of their people. And that's where we get into trouble with our indicators.
Where do you see education and training evolving next to support nursing in exerting its full capabilities to meet the challenges of this global society we live in?
Clearly, we need to do a better job. If this pandemic hasn't showed us now, I don't know what else will, the need to retool our workforce. But we really need to pay much more attention to public health and population health, getting nurse practitioners more clinical experience in the communities and with elderly populations. I saw that actually a lot of associations were trying to get their nurses into leadership positions. I thought, well, why don't we just all work together on this?
Yeah.
So we formed Nurses on Boards Coalition. What we're trying to do is get more nurses on boards that need a health and an advocacy voice. If we go back to what is keeping people healthy and well in the first place, mm-hmm. you know, those social determinants, I'm talking about getting nurses on boards of transportation councils mm-hmm. and public health departments and food banks, maybe neighborhood councils, because mm-hmm. there's not generally a health voice on those types of boards or councils. And I think that's a good example of trying to bring health into all kinds of policies that we need to think about now. COVID-19 has really been a catalyst for change. Mm-hmm. Some people, boy, we didn't see this coming. But, you know, for those people who are in public health,
right.
Mm-hmm. they said, A, we saw this coming, and B, we've been warning that this is coming.
Yeah.
And if we had a better infrastructure, a public health infrastructure, we could have been in a little better shape than we are now. Public health nurses are needed more than ever. Nurse practitioners are needed more than ever. I'm hoping that we can take the lessons learned from this pandemic and really grab hold of those and then bring stakeholders around and say, we got to do better next time because it's coming again.
Dr. Hess-Miller, thank you for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
It's been a pleasure.
Conversations on Healthcare podcast hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter with Dr. Susan Hess-Miller, Senior Advisor for Nursing at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. You can find out more about her work and the issues she talked about at campaignforaction.org. Decoded 8 Book is next.
African Soul American Heart protects orphan girls from South Sudan with medical care and vaccinations, educates them in school and life skills, and empowers them to lead and give back. Information on how to help is available at asahinsudan.org.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, conversations with Kevin Miterman, Jason Mieres, and Brad Chrysler.
Kevin Miterman of Grand Forks, North Dakota, has produced a guitar that he is going to use to auction for the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Made from vintage prairie woods, Jason Mieres talks about you being honored in the Virginia House of Delegates.
My dear friend from Virginia, he helped to produce a resolution which honored the Thomas Jefferson Hour and you, the semi-permanent guest host.
And finally, we talked to Brad Chrysler. Always fun to talk to Brad, and he gives us some pretty insightful thoughts about what's going on in America today. All that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 24th. On the night before D-Day in World War II, General Dwight D. Eisenhower visited with paratroopers of the 101st Airborne Division at a staging base in England. Among the paratroopers was William, or Bill, E. Hayes. Hayes was busy with preparations for parachuting into Normandy. To calm his nervousness, he checked his 70 pounds of equipment, including food, ammunition, and a thermite bomb attached to a parachute strap. At 9:30 p.m., Hayes heard someone approach behind him. "Well, are you ready?" said a voice. "Yeah, I guess so," replied Hayes. Are you scared? The voice asked. You're damned right, Hayes answered, turning around to see General Eisenhower. They visited a little bit. Eisenhower asked about Hayes's work as a civilian. Hayes said he'd been selling paint and wallpaper for Sears, asking Eisenhower if he'd ever heard of them. Eisenhower said, yeah, I guess everybody's bought something from Sears at one time or another. Soon, all of Hayes' squad gathered near them. At that moment, a photographer snapped a photo of Eisenhower encircled by paratroopers. It became a famous D-Day image. Bill Hayes parachuted into Normandy just after midnight. His goal? Destroy a German artillery battery. Landing in a tree, Hayes got down safely and helped cause havoc for German troops near the beachhead on D-Day and in the following days. Hayes was later wounded by shrapnel in the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944, but he recovered. On this date, in 1964, a newspaper story told about Hayes and the famous D-Day photo. When Bill Hayes returned to the U.S., he came back to his home state of Wisconsin to resume working for Sears, and in 1946, Sears promoted him to Fargo and thence to numerous locations. In 1966, Hayes returned to Fargo with his wife, eventually becoming regional manager. After 30 years with Sears, Hayes worked 17 more at Fargo's USDA Metabolism Laboratory. He died in 2006. Hayes gained some small measure of fame from the classic D-Day photo. Helmetless, he stands with charred cork darkening his face, looking up respectfully at Eisenhower, before he jumped into the maelstrom of deadly combat in 1944. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and as we broadcast, I always remind you, we stream as well at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street at prairiepublic.org. Monday on our show, Kristen Knight Pace is one of 31 women in the world to have completed both the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest dog sled races. The Iditarod is more than 1,500 miles long. The Yukon Quest is 1,000 miles. On Monday, we'll hear her discuss her memoir, This Much Country. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.